mediation of an ancestral population, would assume that the ancestors of both populations were still in Africa at that time. Combining this evidence with archaeological analysis of stone tool types, Martinan Torres and Donnell argue for the possibility of continuous Eurasian habitation from at least 1.4 million years ago until the most recent common ancestor of humans and Neanderthals after 800,000 years ago, at which point one lineage migrated back to Africa to become the lineage that evolved into modern humans. The Martinan Torres and Donnell theory becomes more plausible in light of the new genetic evidence. Part of the out-of-Africa allure is the simplifying idea that Africa, and especially East Africa, has always been the cradle of human diversity, and the place where innovation occurred, and that the rest of the world is an evolutionarily inert receptacle. But is there really such a strong case that all the key events in human evolution happened in the same region of the world? The genetic data show that many groups of archaic humans populated Eurasia, and that some of these interbred with modern humans. This forces us to question why the direction of migration would have always been out of Africa and into Eurasia, and whether it could sometimes have been the other way around. The most ancient DNA yet. At the beginning of 2014, Matthias Meyer, Svante Paabo, and their colleagues in Leipzig extended by a factor of around 4, the record for the oldest human DNA obtained, sequencing mitochondrial DNA from a more than 400,000-year-old Homo heidelbergensis individual from the Cima de los Huesos cave system in Spain, where 28 ancient humans were found at the bottom of a 13-meter shaft. The Cima skeletons have early Neanderthal-like traits, and the archaeologists who excavated them have interpreted them as being on the lineage leading to Neanderthals, after the separation from the ancestors of modern humans. 2 years after Meyer and Paabo published mitochondrial DNA data from Cima de los Huesos, they published genome-wide data. Their analysis not only confirmed that the Cima humans were on the Neanderthal lineage, but went further in showing that the Cima humans were more closely related to Neanderthals than they are to Denisovans. These results provide direct evidence that Neanderthal ancestors were already evolving in Europe at least 400,000 years ago, and that the separation of the Neanderthal and Denisovan lineages had already begun by that time. But the Cima data were also perplexing. Cima's mitochondrial genome was more closely related to Denisovans than to Neanderthals, at odds with the genome-wide pattern of it being most closely related to Neanderthals. If there were only one discrepancy between the average relationship measured by the whole genome and the relationship seen in mitochondrial DNA, it might just be possible to believe that this was a statistical fluctuation. But there are two discrepancies in the genetic relationships. The fact that the Cima de los Huesos individual has Denisovan-type mitochondrial DNA, despite being closer to Neanderthals in the rest of the genome, and the fact that the Siberian Denisovan individual has mitochondrial DNA twice as divergent from modern humans and Neanderthals as they were from each other, despite being closer to Neanderthals in the rest of the genome. The coincidence of these two observations is so improbable that it seems more likely that there is a deeper story to unravel. Perhaps the superarchaic humans, the ones who interbred with Denisovans, were a much more important part of Eurasian human population history than we initially imagined. Maybe after separating from the lineage, leading to modern humans around 1.4 to 0.9 million years ago, these superarchaic humans spread across Eurasia and began to evolve the ancient mitochondrial lineage found in the Denisovans and Cima humans. At roughly half this time, another group may have split off the lineage leading to modern humans and then spread throughout Eurasia. This group may have mixed into the superarchaic population, contributing the largest proportion of ancestry to populations in the West that evolved into Neanderthals, and a smaller but still substantial proportion of ancestry to populations in the east that became the ancestors of Denisovans. This scenario would explain the findings of two anciently divergent mitochondrial DNA types in the different groups. It could also explain an odd, unpublished observation I have, that in studying the variation in the time, since the common genetic ancestor of modern human genomes with both Denisovan and Neanderthal genomes, I have not been able to find evidence for a superarchaic population that contributed to Denisovans but not to Neanderthals. Instead, the pattern suggests that Denisovans and Neanderthals both had ancestry from the same superarchaic population, with just a larger proportion present in the Denisovans. Johannes Krauss and colleagues have suggested an alternative theory. Krauss's idea is that several hundred thousand years ago, an early modern human population migrated out of Africa and mixed with groups like the one that lived in Cima de los Huesos, replacing their mitochondrial DNA along with a bit of the rest of their genomes, and creating a mixed population that evolved into true Neanderthals. The idea might seem complicated, but in fact it could explain multiple disparate observations, beyond the fact that Neanderthals had a mitochondrial sequence much more similar to modern humans than it did to either the Cima de los Huesos individual or the Siberian Denisovan. It could account for the fact that the estimated date of the common ancestor of humans and Neanderthals in mitochondrial DNA, 470,000 to 360,000 years ago, is paradoxically more recent than the estimated date of separation of the ancestors of these two populations, based on the analysis of the whole genome, 770,000 to 550,000 years ago. It could also explain how it was that Neanderthals and modern humans both used complex Middle Stone Age methods of manufacturing stone tools, even though the earliest evidence for this tool type is hundreds of thousands of years after the genetically estimated separation of the Neanderthals and modern human lineages. The theory finally becomes more plausible in light of a study led by Sergei Castellano and Adam Siepel that suggested up to 2% interbreeding into the ancestors of Neanderthals from an early modern human lineage. If Krauss's theory is right, this could have been the lineage that spread the mitochondrial DNA found in all Neanderthals. Whatever explains these patterns, it is clear that we have much more to learn. The period before 50,000 years ago was a busy time in Eurasia, with multiple human populations arriving from Africa, beginning at least 1.8 million years ago. These populations split into sister groups, diverged, and mixed again with each other, and with new arrivals. Most of those groups have since gone extinct, at least in their pure forms. We have known for a while, from skeletons and archaeology, that there was some impressive human diversity prior to the migration of modern humans out of Africa. However, we did not know before ancient DNA was extracted and studied that Eurasia was a locus of human evolution that rivaled Africa. Against this background, the fierce debates about whether modern humans and Neanderthals interbred when they met in Western Eurasia, which have been definitively resolved in favor of interbreeding events that made a contribution to billions of people living today, seem merely anticipatory. Europe is a peninsula, a modest-sized tip of Eurasia, given the wide diversity of Denisovans and Neanderthals already represented in DNA sequences from at least three populations separated from each other by hundreds of thousands of years, namely Siberian Denisovans, Australo-Denisovans, and Neanderthals, the right way to view these populations is as members of a loosely related family of highly evolved archaic humans who inhabited a vast region of Eurasia. Ancient DNA has allowed us to peer deep into time, and forced us to question our understanding of the past. If the first Neanderthal genome published in 2010 opened a sluice in the dam of knowledge about the deep past, the Denisovan genome and subsequent ancient DNA discoveries opened the floodgates, producing a torrent of findings that have disrupted many of the comfortable understandings we had before. And that was only the beginning. Part 2. How we got to where we are today. 4. Humanity's ghosts. The discovery of the ancient North Eurasians. When confronted with the diversity of life, evolutionary biologists are drawn to the metaphor of a tree. Charles Darwin, at the inception of the field, wrote, "The affinities of all the beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. The green and budding twigs may represent existing species, the limbs divided into great branches, and these into lesser and lesser branches were themselves once, when the tree was small, budding twigs. Present populations budded from past ones, which branched from a common root in Africa. If the tree metaphor is right, then any population today will have a single ancestral population at each point in the past. The significance of the tree is that once a population separates, it does not remix, as fusions of branches cannot occur." The avalanche of new data that has become available in the wake of the genome revolution has shown just how wrong the tree metaphor is for summarizing the relationship among modern human populations. My closest collaborator, the applied mathematician Nick Patterson, developed a series of formal tests to evaluate whether a tree model is an accurate summary of real population relationships. Foremost among these was the four population test, which, as described in Part 1, examines hundreds of thousands of positions on the genome, where individuals vary. For example, where some people have an adenine, one of the four nucleic acids, or letters, of DNA, and others have a guanine, reflecting a mutation that occurred deep in the past. If a set of four populations is described by a tree, then the frequencies of their mutations are expected to have a simple relationship. The most natural way to test the tree model is to measure the frequencies of mutations in the genomes of two populations that we hypothesize have split from the same branch. If a tree model is correct, the frequencies of mutations in the two populations will have changed randomly since their separation from the other two more distantly related populations. And so the frequency differences between these two pairs of populations will be statistically independent. If a tree model is wrong, there will be a correlation between the frequency differences, pointing to the likelihood of mixture between the branches. The four population test was central to our demonstration that Neanderthals are more closely related to non-Africans than to Africans, and thus that there was interbreeding between Neanderthals and non-Africans. But findings about interbreeding between archaic and modern humans are only a small part of what has been discovered with four population tests. My laboratory's first major discovery using the four population test came when we tested the widely held view that Native Americans and East Asians are sister populations that descend from a common ancestral branch that separated earlier from the ancestors of Europeans and sub-Saharan Africans. To our surprise, we found that at mutations not shared with sub-Saharan Africans, Europeans are more closely related to Native Americans than they are to East Asians. It would be tempting to argue that this observation has a trivial explanation, such as Native Americans having some ancestry from European migrants over the last 500 years. But we found the same pattern in every Native American population we studied, including those we could prove had no European admixture. The scenario of Native Americans and Europeans descending from a common population that split earlier from East Asians was also contradicted by the data. Something was deeply wrong with the standard tree model of population relationships. We wrote a paper describing these results, suggesting that the patterns reflect an episode of mixture deep in the ancestry of Native Americans, a coming together of people related to Europeans and people related to East Asians prior to crossing the Bering land bridge between Asia and the Americas. We submitted this paper, Ancient Mixture in the Ancestry of Native Americans, in 2009. It was accepted, pending minor revisions, but as it turns out, we never published it. Even as we were making our final revisions to that paper, Patterson discovered something even stranger, which made us realize we had understood only part of the story. To explain his discovery, I need to describe another statistical test we devised, the three population test, which evaluates a test population for evidence of mixture. If the test population is a mixture of lineages related to the comparison populations in two different ways, as African Americans are a mixture of Europeans and West Africans, then the frequencies of the test population's mutations are expected to be intermediate between those of the two comparison populations. In contrast, if mixture did not occur, there is no reason to expect the frequencies of mutations in the population to be intermediate. Thus, the scenarios of mixture and no mixture yield two qualitatively very different patterns. When we applied the three population tests to diverse human populations, we detected negative statistics when the test population was Northern European, proving that population mixture occurred in the ancestors of Northern Europeans. We tried all possible pairs of comparison populations from more than 50 worldwide populations and found that the mixture evidence was strongest when one comparison population was Southern European, especially Sardinians, and the other was Native Americans. It was clearly Native American populations that produced the most negative values, as we found that the statistic was more negative when we used Native Americans for the second comparison population than when we used East Asians, Siberians, or New Guineans. What we had found was evidence that people in Northern Europe, such as the French, are descended from a mixture of populations, one of which shared more ancestry with present-day Native Americans than with any other population living today. How could we understand the results of both the three population test and the four population test? We proposed that more than 15,000 years ago, there was a population living in Northern Eurasia that was not the primary ancestral population of the present-day inhabitants of the region. Some people from this population migrated east across Siberia and contributed to the population across the Bering Land Bridge and gave rise to Native Americans. Others migrated west and contributed to Europeans. This would explain why today the evidence of mixture in Europeans is strong when using Native Americans as a surrogate for the ancestral population, and not as strong in indigenous Siberians, who plausibly descend from more recent post-Ice Age migrations into Siberia from more southern parts of East Asia. We call this proposed new population the ancient North Eurasians. At the time we proposed them, they were a ghost, a population that we can infer existed in the past based on statistical reconstruction, but that no longer exists in unmixed form. The ancient North Eurasians would without a doubt have been called a race had they lived today, as we could show that they must have been genetically about as differentiated from all other Eurasian populations who lived at the time as today's West Eurasians, Native Americans, and East Asians are from one another. Although they have not left unmixed descendants, the ancient North Eurasians have in fact been extraordinarily successful. If we put together all the genetic material that they have contributed to present-day populations, they account for literally hundreds of millions of genomes worth of people. All told, more than half the world's population derives between 5% and 40% of their genomes from the ancient North Eurasians. The case of the ancient North Eurasians showed that while the tree is a good analogy for the relationships among species, because species rarely interbreed, and so like real tree limbs are not expected to grow back together after they branch, it is a dangerous analogy for human populations. The genome revolution has taught us that great mixtures of highly divergent populations have occurred repeatedly. Instead of a tree, a better metaphor may be a trellis, branching and remixing far back into the past. The ghost is found. At the end of 2013, Eska Villislev and his colleagues published genome-wide data from the bones of a boy who had lived at the Malta site in south-central Siberia around 24,000 years ago. The Malta genome had its strongest genetic affinity to Europeans and Native Americans, and far less affinity to the Siberians who live in the region today, just as we had predicted for the ghost population of the ancient North Eurasians. The Malta genome has now become the prototype sample for the ancient North Eurasians. Paleontologists would call it a type specimen, the individual used in the scientific literature to define a newly discovered group. With the Malta genome in hand, the other pieces of the puzzle snapped into place. It was no longer necessary to reconstruct from present-day populations what had happened long ago. Instead, with a genome sampled directly from the ghost population, it was possible to understand migrations and population admixtures from tens of thousands of years ago, as if we were analyzing recent history. What became possible with the Malta genome is the best example I know of the power of ancient DNA to uncover history that, until then, could only be dimly perceived from present-day data. The analysis of the Malta genome made it clear that Native Americans derive about a third of their ancestry from the ancient North Eurasians, and the remainder from East Asians. It is this major mixture that explains why Europeans are genetically closer to Native Americans than they are to East Asians. Our unpublished manuscript, claiming that Native Americans descend from a mixture of East Asian and West Eurasian related lineages, had been correct. But it was just not the whole story. The paper was overtaken by events in the fast-moving field of ancient DNA. What Vilislav and colleagues found went far beyond what we have been able to do by relying on only modern populations. The Vilislav team not only proved that Native Americans issued from population mixture, which we had not succeeded in doing, as we could not rule out an alternative scenario, but they also showed that the mixture was part of a larger story. The finding that several of the great populations outside of Africa today are profoundly mixed was at odds with what most scientists expected. Prior to the genome revolution, I, like most others, had assumed that the big genetic clusters of populations we see today reflect the deep splits of the past. But in fact, the big clusters today are themselves the result of mixtures of very different populations that existed earlier. We have since detected similar patterns in every population we have analyzed: East Asians, South Asians, West Africans, Southern Africans. There was never a single trunk population in the human past. It has been mixtures all the way down. The Ghost of the Near East. Throughout 2013, Yosif Lazaridis, in my laboratory, was troubled by a result that could not be understood without ancient DNA. Lazaridis was trying to understand a peculiar four-population test result, showing that East Asians, present-day Europeans, and pre-farming European hunter-gatherers from around 8,000 years ago are not related to one another according to the tree model. Instead, his analysis showed that East Asians today are genetically more closely related on average to the ancestors of ancient European hunter-gatherers than they are to the ancestors of present-day Europeans. Ancient DNA studies prior to his work had already shown that present-day Europeans derive some of their ancestry from migrations of farmers from the Near East, who I had assumed were derived from the same ancestral population as European hunter-gatherers. Lazaridis now realized that the ancestry of the first European farmers was distinct from European hunter-gatherers in some way. Something more complicated was going on. Lazaridis weighed two alternative explanations. One explanation was that there was mixture between the ancestors of ancient European hunter-gatherers and ancient East Asians, bringing these two populations together genetically. There are no insurmountable geographic barriers between Europe and East Asia, so this was a distinct possibility. The alternative explanation was that early European farmers, who contributed much of the DNA to present-day Europeans, derived some of their ancestry from a population that split early from the main group that peopled Eurasia. This would render East Asians less similar to present-day Europeans than they are to pre-farming European hunter-gatherers. Once the genome sequence from Malta became available, Lazaridis instantly solved the problem. With Malta in hand, he carried out 4 population tests among various sets of 4 populations. Malta and the pre-farming European hunter-gatherers appeared to descend from a common ancestral population that arose after the separation from East Asians and sub-Saharan Africans. The data were consistent with a simple tree, but when Lazaridis replaced ancient European hunter-gatherers in this statistic with either present-day Europeans or with early European farmers, the tree metaphor could no longer describe the data. Present-day Europeans and Near Easterners are mixed. They carry within them ancestry from a divergent Eurasian lineage that branched from Malta, European hunter-gatherers, and East Asians, before those 3 lineages separated from one another. Lazaridis called this lineage Basal Eurasian, to denote its position as the deepest split in the radiation of lineages contributing to non-Africans. The Basal Eurasians were a new ghost population, one as important as the ancient North Eurasians, measured by the sheer number of descendant genomes they had left behind. The extent of the deviations of the 4 population test away from the value of 0 that would be expected if the populations were related by a simple tree indicates that this ghost population contributed about a quarter of the ancestry of present-day Europeans and Near Easterners. It also contributed comparable proportions of ancestry to Iranians and Indians. No one has yet collected ancient DNA from the Basal Eurasians. Finding such a sample is at present one of the holy grails in the field of ancient DNA, just as finding the ancient North Eurasians had been before the Malta discovery. But we know that Basal Eurasians existed, and even without having their ancient DNA, we know important facts about them based on the genomic fragments they have left behind in samples, for which we do have data. An extraordinary feature of the Basal Eurasians, compared to all other lineages that have contributed to present-day people outside of Africa, is that they harbored little or no Neanderthal ancestry. In 2016, we analyzed ancient DNA from the Near East to show that people who lived in the region 14,000 to 10,000 years ago had approximately 50% Basal Eurasian ancestry, about twice the proportion in Europeans today. Plotting the proportion of Basal Eurasian ancestry against the proportion of Neanderthal ancestry, we realized that the less Basal Eurasian ancestry a non-African person has, the more Neanderthal ancestry he or she has. Thus, non-Africans who have 0% Basal Eurasian ancestry have twice as much Neanderthal DNA as ones with 50% Basal Eurasian ancestry. By extrapolation, we might expect 100% Basal Eurasians to have no Neanderthal ancestry at all. So wherever the Neanderthal admixture occurred, it seems to have largely happened after the other branches of the non-African family tree separated from Basal Eurasians. A tempting idea is that the Basal Eurasians represent the descendants of a second wave of migration of modern humans north of the Sahara Desert, well after the dispersal of the population that interbred with Neanderthals. However, this is not correct, as the Basal Eurasian lineage shares much of the history of other non-Africans, including descent from the same relatively small population that founded all non-African lineages more than 50,000 years ago. The ancient presence of the Basal Eurasians in Eurasia becomes even clearer when one considers that peoples who lived 10,000 years ago or more in what are now Iran and Israel each had around 50% Basal Eurasian ancestry, despite the clear genetic evidence that these two populations had been isolated from one another for tens of thousands of years. This suggests the possibility that there were multiple highly divergent Basal Eurasian lineages coexisting in the ancient Near East, not exchanging many migrants until farming expanded. The basal Eurasians were a major and distinctive source of human genetic variation, with multiple subpopulations persisting for a long period of time. Where could the basal Eurasians have lived, isolated as they seem to have been for tens of thousands of years from other non-African lineages? In the absence of ancient DNA, we can only speculate. It is possible that they may have sojourned in North Africa, which is difficult to reach from southern parts of the African continent because of the barrier of the Sahara Desert, and which is more ecologically linked to West Eurasia. Today, the peoples of North Africa owe most of their ancestry to West Eurasian migrants, making the deep genetic past in that region difficult to discern. However, archaeological studies have revealed ancient cultures there that could potentially have corresponded to the basal Eurasians. The Nile Valley, for example, has been occupied by humans for the entire period since present-day Eurasians diverged from their closest relatives in sub-Saharan Africa. A hint about the possible homeland of the basal Eurasians come from the Natufians, hunter-gatherers who lived after around 14,000 years ago in the southwestern parts of the Near East. They were the first people known to have lived in permanent dwellings. They did not migrate from place to place searching for food, despite being hunter-gatherers. They built large stone structures and actively managed local wild plants before their successors became full-fledged farmers. Their skulls, as well as the stone tools they made, are similar in shape to those of North Africans who lived around the same time, and it has been suggested on this basis that the Natufians migrated to the Near East from North Africa. In 2016, my laboratory published ancient DNA from 6 Natufians from Israel, and we found that they share with early Iranian hunter-gatherers the highest proportions of basal Eurasian ancestry in the Near East. However, our ancient DNA data cannot determine where the ancestors of the Natufians lived, as we do not yet have comparable ancient DNA data from any other populations that lived at this time or earlier in North Africa, Arabia, or the southwestern Near East. And even if a genetic connection between Natufians and North Africa is established, it will not be the whole story, as it cannot explain the equally high proportions of basal Eurasian ancestry in the ancient hunter-gatherers and farmers of Iran and the Caucasus. The ghosts of early Europeans. The discovery of one major ghost population after another, ancient North Eurasians and basal Eurasians, might make it seem as if ancient DNA is unnecessary, since the existence of ghosts can be predicted from modern populations. But statistical reconstruction can only go so far. With data from present-day people, it is difficult to probe further back in time than the most recent mixture event. Moreover, because humans are so mobile, it is impossible to determine with any confidence where ancestral populations lived, based on analyses of the genomes of their descendants. With ancient DNA directly extracted from the ghosts, however, it is possible to project further back in time, revealing even more ancient ghosts than can be recovered from modern data alone. So it was when the Malta genome was sequenced. We discovered the Malta genome statistically, but once we had access to the sequence, we were able to discover the even more distant basal Eurasians. In 2016, the lid of Pandora's box opened wide, and a whole mob of ancient ghosts whirled out. My laboratory assembled genome-wide data from 51 ancient modern humans in Eurasia, most of them from Europe, who lived between 45,000 and 7,000 years ago. These samples spanned the entire period of the last glacial maximum, which occurred between 25,000 and 19,000 years ago, when glaciers covered the northern and middle latitudes of Europe, so that all humans there lived in refuges in its southern peninsulas. Prior to our work, just a few remains provided genetic data from this period, and the picture that emerged from their analysis was static and monochromatic. But with all our new data, we could show that repeated population transformations, replacements, migrations, and mixtures had taken place over this vast stretch of time. When analyzing ancient DNA data, The usual approach is to compare ancient individuals to present-day ones, trying to get bearings on the past from the perspective of the present. But when this was done by Xiaomei Fu in my laboratory, her results shed little light on these ancient hunter-gatherers. The differences among humans today are hardly relevant to those that existed in Europe at the time depths she was studying. Fu needed to confront the data on their own terms. To do this, she began by comparing the ancient individuals to one another. She grouped them in four clusters that contained many samples that were similar both genetically and with respect to their archaeologically determined dates. Now she only needed to understand the relationships among the clusters. There were also some individuals who did not cluster with any others, especially among the oldest individuals. With her samples organized in this way, Fu was able to break down the story of the first 35,000 years of modern humans in West Eurasia into at least five key events. Event one was the spread of modern humans into Western Eurasia, and is evident in the two most ancient samples, an approximately 45,000-year-old individual whose leg bone had been found eroding out of a riverbank in western Siberia, and an approximately 40,000-year-old individual whose lower jaw was found in a cave in Romania. Both individuals were no more closely related to later European hunter-gatherers than they were to present-day East Asians. This finding showed that they were members of pioneer modern human populations that initially flourished, but whose descendants largely disappeared. The existence of these pioneer populations makes it clear that the past is not an inevitable march toward the present. Human history is full of dead ends, and we should not expect the people who lived in any one place in the past to be the direct ancestors of those who live there today. Around 39,000 years ago, a supervolcano near present-day Naples in Italy dropped an estimated 300 cubic kilometers of ash across Europe, separating archaeological layers preceding it from those that succeeded it. Almost no Neanderthal remains or tools are found above this layer, suggesting that the climate disruption produced by the volcano, which could have produced multi-year winters, may have compounded competition with modern humans to create a crisis that drove Neanderthals to extinction. But the Neanderthals were not the only ones in crisis. Most modern human archaeological cultures that left remains below the ash layer left none above it. Many modern humans disappeared as dramatically as their Neanderthal contemporaries. Event 2 was the spread of the lineage that gave rise to all later hunter-gatherers in Europe. Fu's four population tests showed that both an approximately 37,000-year-old individual from Eastern Europe, present-day European Russia, and an approximately 35,000-year-old individual from Western Europe, present-day Belgium, were part of a population that contributed to all later Europeans, including today's. Fu also used four population tests to show that during the entire period from around 37,000 to around 14,000 years ago, almost all the individuals she analyzed from Europe could be rather well described as descending from a single common ancestral population that had not experienced mixture with non-European populations. Archaeologists have shown that after the volcanic eruption around 39,000 years ago, a modern human culture spread across Europe making stone tools of a type known as orientation, and that this replaced the diverse stone tool-making styles that existed before. Thus, genetic and archaeological evidence both point to multiple independent migrations of early modern human pioneers into Europe, some of which went extinct and were replaced by a more homogeneous population and culture. Event 3 was the coming of the people who made Gravettian tools, who dominated most of Europe between around 33,000 and 22,000 years ago. The material remains they left behind include voluptuous female statuettes, as well as musical instruments and dazzling cave art. Compared to the people who made orientation tools who came before them, the people who made Gravettian tools were much more deliberate about burying their dead. And as a result, we have many more skeletons from this period than we do from the orientation period. We extracted DNA from Gravettian-era individuals buried in present-day Belgium, Italy, France, Germany, and the Czech Republic. They were all genetically very similar, despite their extraordinary geographic dispersal. Fu's analysis indicated that most of their ancestry derived from the same sublineage of European hunter-gatherers as the 37,000-year-old individual from Far Eastern Europe, and that they then spread west, displacing the sublineage associated with orination tools and represented in the 35,000-year-old Belgian individual. The changes in artifact styles associated with the rise of the Gravettian culture were thus driven by the spread of new people. Event 4 was heralded by a skeleton from present-day Spain, dating to around 19,000 years ago, one of the first individuals known to be associated with the Magdalenian culture, whose members over the next 5,000 years migrated to the northeast out of their warm weather refuge, chasing the retreating ice sheets into present-day France and Germany. The data once again showed a correspondence between the archaeological culture and genetic discoveries, documenting the spread of people into Central Europe who were not directly descended from the Gravettians, who had preceded them. There was also a surprise. Most of the ancestry of individuals associated with Magdalenian culture came from the sublineage represented by the 35,000-year-old individual from Belgium, who was associated with ornation tools, but who was later succeeded at the same site by people who used Gravettian tools and carried DNA similar to others in Europe associated with that culture of Eastern European origin. Here was yet another ghost population that contributed to later groups in mixed form. The ornation lineage had not died out, but instead had persisted in some geographic pocket, possibly in Western Europe, before its resurgence at the end of the Ice Age. Event 5 happened around 14,000 years ago, during the first strong warming period after the last Ice Age, a major climatic change known as the Bolling-Alerod. Geological reconstructions reveal that at this time, the Alpine glacial wall that extended down to the Mediterranean Sea near present-day Nice finally melted after about 10,000 years of dividing the west and east of Europe. Plants and animals from southeastern Europe, the Italian and Balkan peninsulas, migrated in abundance into southwestern Europe. Our four population tests on our ancient DNA data show that something similar happened with humans. After around 14,000 years ago, a group of hunter-gatherers spread across Europe with ancestry quite different from that of the people associated with the preceding Magdalenian culture, whom they largely displaced. Individuals living in Europe between 37,000 and 14,000 years ago were all plausibly descended from a common ancestral population that separated earlier from the ancestors of lineages represented in the Near East today. But after around 14,000 years ago, Western European hunter-gatherers became much more closely related to present-day Near Easterners. This proved that new migration occurred between the Near East and Europe around this time. We do not yet have ancient DNA from the period before 14,000 years ago from southeastern Europe and the Near East. We can therefore only surmise population movements around this time. The people who had waited out the Ice Age in southern Europe became dominant across the entire European continent following the melting of the Alpine glacial wall. Perhaps these same people also expanded east into Anatolia, and their descendants spread farther to the Near East, bringing together the genetic heritages of Europe and the Near East more than 5,000 years before farmers spread Near Eastern ancestry back into Europe by migrating in the opposite direction. The genetic formation of present-day West Eurasians. Today, the peoples of West Eurasia, the vast region spanning Europe, the Near East, and much of Central Asia, are genetically highly similar. The physical similarity of West Eurasian populations was recognized in the 18th century by scholars who classified the people of West Eurasia as Caucasoids, to differentiate them from East Asian Mongoloids, Sub-Saharan African Negroids, and Australoids of Australia and New Guinea. In the 2000s, whole genome data emerged, as a more powerful way to cluster present-day human populations than physical features. The whole genome data at first seemed to validate some of the old categories. The most common way to measure the genetic similarity between two populations is by taking the square of the difference in mutation frequencies between them, and then averaging across thousands of independent mutations across the genome to get a precisely determined number. Measured in this way, populations within West Eurasia are typically around 7 times more similar to one another than West Eurasians are to East Asians. When frequencies of mutations are plotted on a map, West Eurasia appears homogeneous, from the Atlantic facade of Europe to the steppes of Central Asia. There is a sharp gradient of change in Central Asia before another region of homogeneity is reached in East Asia. How did the present-day population structure emerge from the one that existed in the deep past? We and other ancient DNA laboratories found in 2016 that the formation of the present-day West Eurasian population was propelled by the spread of food producers. Farming began between 12 and 11,000 years ago in southeastern Turkey and northern Syria, where local hunter-gatherers began domesticating most of the plants and animals many West Eurasians still depend upon today, including wheat, barley, rye, peas, cows, pigs, and sheep. After around 9,000 years ago, farming began spreading west to present-day Greece, and roughly at the same time began spreading east, reaching the Indus Valley in present-day Pakistan. Within Europe, farming spread west along the Mediterranean coast to Spain and northwest to Germany through the Danube River Valley, until it reached Scandinavia in the north and the British Isles in the west, the most extreme places where this type of economy was practical. Until 2016, getting genome-wide ancient DNA from the Near East to assess the extent to which these changes in the archaeological record were propelled by movements of people had failed, as the warm climate of the Near East quickens chemical reactions, accelerating the rate of breakdown of DNA. However, two technical breakthroughs changed this. One came from a method developed by Matthias Meyer, which involved enriching DNA extracted from ancient bones for human sequences of interest. This approach makes ancient DNA analysis up to 1,000 times more cost-effective and gives access to samples that would otherwise provide too little DNA to study. Working together with Meyer, we adapted this method to make possible genome-wide analysis of large numbers of samples. The second breakthrough was the recognition that the inner ear part of the skull, known as the petrous bone, preserves a far higher density of DNA than most other skeletal parts, up to 100 times more for each milligram of bone powder. Within the petrous bone, the anthropologist Ron Pinhassi, working in Dublin, showed that the motherlode of DNA is found in the cochlea, the snail-shaped organ of hearing. Ancient DNA analysis of petrous bones in 2015 and 2016 broke through one barrier after another and made it possible for the first time to get ancient DNA from the warm Near East. Working with Pinhassi, we obtained ancient DNA from 44 ancient Near Easterners across much of the geographic cradle of farming. The results revealed that around 10,000 years ago, at the time that farming was beginning to spread, the population structure of West Eurasia was far from the genetic monoculture we observe today. The farmers of the western mountains of Iran, who may have been the first to domesticate goats, were genetically directly derived from the hunter-gatherers who preceded them. Similarly, the first farmers of present-day Israel and Jordan were descended largely from the Natufian hunter-gatherers who preceded them. But these two populations were also very genetically different from each other. We and another research group found that the degree of genetic differentiation between the first farmers of the western part of the Near East, the Fertile Crescent, including Anatolia and the Levant, and the first farmers of the eastern part, Iran, was about as great as the differentiation between Europeans and East Asians today. In the Near East, the expansion of farming was accomplished not just by the movement of people, as happened in Europe, but also by the spread of common ideas across genetically very different groups. The high differentiation of human populations in the Near East 10,000 years ago was a specific instance of a broader pattern across the vast region of West Eurasia, documented by Yosif Lazaridis, who led the analysis. Analyzing our data, he found that about 10,000 years ago, there were at least four major populations in West Eurasia: the farmers of the Fertile Crescent, the farmers of Iran, the hunter-gatherers of Central and Western Europe, and the hunter-gatherers of Eastern Europe. All these populations differed from one another, as much as Europeans differ from East Asians today. Scholars interested in trying to create ancestry-based racial classifications, had they lived 10,000 years ago, would have categorized these groups as races, even though none of these groups survives in unmixed form today. Spurred by the revolutionary technology of plant and animal domestication, which could support much higher population densities than hunting and gathering, the farmers of the Near East began migrating and mixing with their neighbors. But instead of one group displacing all the others and pushing them to extinction, as had occurred in some of the previous spreads of hunter-gatherers in Europe, in the Near East, all the expanding groups contributed to later populations. The farmers in present-day Turkey expanded into Europe. The farmers in present-day Israel and Jordan expanded into East Africa, and their genetic legacy is greatest in present-day Ethiopia. Farmers related to those in present-day Iran expanded into India, as well as the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas. They mixed with local populations there and established new economies based on herding that allowed the agricultural revolution to spread into parts of the world inhospitable to domesticated crops. The different food-producing populations also mixed with one another, a process that was accelerated by technological developments in the Bronze Age after around 5,000 years ago. This meant that the high genetic substructure that had previously characterized West Eurasia collapsed into the present-day very low level of genetic differentiation by the Bronze Age. It is an extraordinary example of how technology, in this case domestication, contributed to homogenization, not just culturally, but genetically. It shows that what is happening with the Industrial Revolution and the information revolution in our own time is not unique in the history of our species. The fusion of these highly different populations into today's West Eurasians is vividly evident in what might be considered the classic Northern European look: blue eyes, light skin, and blonde hair. Analysis of ancient DNA data shows that Western European hunter-gatherers around 8,000 years ago had blue eyes, but dark skin and dark hair, a combination that is rare today. The first farmers of Europe mostly had light skin, but dark hair and brown eyes. Thus, light skin in Europe largely owes its origins to migrating farmers. The earliest known example of the classic European blonde hair mutation is in an ancient northern Eurasian from the Lake Baikal region of eastern Siberia from 17,000 years ago. The hundreds of millions of copies of this mutation in Central and Western Europe today likely derive from a massive migration into the region of people bearing ancient North Eurasian ancestry, an event that is related in the next chapter. Surprisingly, the ancient DNA revolution, through its discovery of the pervasiveness of ghost populations and their mixture, is fueling a critique of race that has been raised by scholars in the past, but was never prominent because of a lack of support from hard scientific facts. By demonstrating that the genetic fault lines in West Eurasia between 10,000 and 4,000 years ago were entirely different from today's, the ancient DNA revolution has shown that today's classifications do not reflect fundamental, pure units of biology. Instead, today's divisions are recent phenomena, with their origin in repeating mixtures and migrations. The findings of the ancient DNA revolution suggest that the mixtures will continue. Mixture is fundamental to who we are, and we need to embrace it, not deny that it occurred. 5. The Making of Modern Europe. Strange Sardinia. In 2009, geneticists led by Joaquin Berger sequenced stretches of mitochondrial DNA from ancient European hunter-gatherers, and some of the earliest farmers of Europe. Although mitochondrial DNA is hundreds of thousands of times shorter than the rest of the genome, it has enough variation to allow categorization of the peoples of the world into distinct types. Nearly all ancient hunter-gatherers carried one set of mitochondrial DNA types, but the farmers who succeeded them carried no more than a few percent of those types, and their DNA was more similar to that seen today in southern Europe and the Near East. It was clear that the farmers came from a population that did not descend from European hunter-gatherers. Mitochondrial DNA is only a small portion of the genome, however, and the whole genome studies that followed delivered strange results. In 2012, a team of geneticists sequenced the genome of the Iceman, a natural mummy dating to approximately 5,300 years ago that was discovered in 1991 on a melting glacier in the Alps. The cold had preserved his body and equipment, providing a vivid snapshot of what obviously had been an extraordinarily complex culture dating to thousands of years before the arrival of writing. His skin was covered with dozens of tattoos. He wore a woven grass cloak and finely sewn shoes. He carried a copper-bladed axe and a kit for lighting fires. An arrowhead in his shoulder and a torn artery showed that he had been shot and had stumbled to the top of a mountain pass before collapsing. Based on the isotopes of the elements strontium, lead, and oxygen in the enamel capping his teeth, it seemed likely he had grown up in a nearby valley, where isotopes contained in groundwater and plants, and derived from the local rocks, had similar ratios. But the ancient DNA data showed that his closest genetic relatives are not present-day alpine people. Instead, his closest relatives today are the people of Sardinia, an island in the Mediterranean Sea. This strange link to present-day Sardinians kept turning up. In the same year that the Iceman's genome was published, Pontus Skoglund, Matthias Jakobsen, and colleagues at the University of Uppsala published four genome sequences from individuals who lived about 5,000 years ago in Sweden. A leading theory up until their study was that the Swedish hunter-gatherers who lived at that time descended from farmers who had adapted a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to exploit the rich fisheries of the Baltic Sea, and were not directly descended from the hunter-gatherers who had lived in northern Europe, including Sweden, several thousand years earlier. But ancient DNA disproved this theory. Instead of being genetically close to each other, the farmers and hunter-gatherers were almost as different from each other as Europeans are from East Asians today. And the farmers once again had that strange link to Sardinians. Skoglund and Jakobsen proposed a new model to explain these findings, that migrating farmers, whose ancestors originated in the Near East, spread over Europe with little mixture with the hunter-gatherers they encountered along the way. A sharp contrast to Luca Cavalli-Sforza's model for the farming expansion into Europe that had been popular until this time, and that emphasized extensive mixture and interaction with the local hunter-gatherers during the expansion. The new model would not only explain the striking genetic contrast between hunter-gatherers and farmers in Sweden around 5,000 years ago. It would also explain why the ancient farmers were genetically similar to present-day Sardinians, who plausibly descend from a migration of farmers to that island around 8,000 years ago that largely displaced the previous hunter-gatherers. Isolated on Sardinia, the descendants of these farmers were minimally affected by demographic events that later transformed the populations of mainland Europe. So far, so good. This new model explained the genetic composition of most Europeans up until around 5,000 years ago. But Skoglund and Jakobsen also went further and proposed that these two sources, hunter-gatherers and farmers, might have contributed almost all the ancestry of Europeans living today. Here, they missed something extraordinarily important. A cloud on the horizon. In 2012, it seemed that the big question of the ancestral sources of present-day European populations might be solved. But there was an observation that didn't fit. In that year, Nick Patterson published a perplexing result from his three-population test. As described in the previous chapter, He showed that the frequencies of mutations in Northern Europeans today tend to be intermediate between those of Southern Europeans and Native Americans. He hypothesized